last time we had this year, we spoke about the expulsion of Jews from Spain. And one of the major, major players in the expulsion was the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel, Abarbanel's Jewish name is Yitzchak. And he's traditionally called Don Yitzchak Abarbanel. Don is like Lord or Sir in Spanish. Born in 1437, died in 1508. He was originally from Portugal. He was a well-known, quantified genius. This is actually like taking a page out of Ashkenazi Jewry, because it's not really totally true. In other words, it's amongst Sephardi Gedolei Torah in the times of the Rishonim. Those who were, I think doctor was the most common, and after that was rabbi. Doctor, then rabbi. However, we saw amongst Ashkenazi Rishonim, I don't know if there were any doctors. Ashkenazi doctor Rishonim? I don't know if there were any.
The Quran.
Rishonim.
The Quran.
Thank you. We're not going to get to the guy this year.
He wasn't a doctor.
He wasn't a doctor either. You're right. Amongst Ashkenazi Rishonim, we didn't find any doctors, but we did see that Rabbeinu Tam was a big banker. Now, it is definitely true that Jews were involved in banking in Spain, and not for the same reasons they were in France. In France and Germany, Jews were involved in banking because initially the church didn't allow Christian upon Christian usury interest. They did allow it to Jews, and again, initially there was government backing, so Jews were very heavily involved in banking, and Rabbeinu Tam was a big major league banker. There were Jews involved in Spain. It was not for the same reasoning. Rather, that Spain, until 1391, was a relatively open society, and Jews were not barred from that many things. So you do find Jewish bankers, but there are not that many of them who were rabbis. And one of the exceptions is the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel was a banker and a government minister, etc., etc. Initially in Portugal, he was accused of treason. He moved to Spain, and he was unemployed for around 2 years. And in those 2 years, he wrote his Perushim on Yeshua, Shavtim, and Shmuel. Now, the Abarbanel, I mentioned this briefly, but I'm going to say it again because now we're by the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel writes a footnote, a postnote, saying how long it took him to write on Yeshua and Shavtim. You guys remember that? Yeshua took him how long? 16 days. Shavtim, hard safer, 25 days. Shmuel, he took 2 months due to the complexity of the safer. Now, as I said 2 weeks ago when I spoke about it, I think it's pretty obvious that the Abarbanel didn't just sit down and say, let's see what I have to say about this book. Obviously, the Abarbanel had spent a lot of his spare time, learning Mikra, learning other than learning Mikra, Midrash, and Gemaras, etc. And now that he had time, he had the Yeshiva Das, he had the tranquility of mind to sit down and write it down. But he obviously had his concept well thought out before he started writing, because if not, I don't personally believe it's... I mean, the Rambam, he won't put this way, in my personal belief. The Rambam spent 10 years writing Yad HaZakah, okay? Okay, of course, Shas is a lot more complicated than Nach, and thus that it's not just Shas, it's when you're writing a Sefer, which is a Halacha L'maisa, like the Rambam is, you're a careful person like the Rambam, but you're not just going to write something down. You're not going to learn this thing and say, okay, I think it was like this. We're talking about real conclusions that the Rambam had to come to with his knowledge of Shas behind him. Anyway, so still, it's quite impressive achievement. And an example of the pasuk in Tehillim, Ruvei Toras Lo Shashuai Az Avadati Ba'ani. Now, he was very involved in major, again, in Spanish. He was hired by Ferdinand. Ferdinand, who was really, again, he was really king of Aragon. He was married to Isabella, who was the queen of Castile. And Ferdinand decided its time has come. They're going to conquer Granada, the last remaining Muslim kingdom. Now, I didn't write down the dates, but I'm pretty sure it was a six-year campaign. And the way they were able to finance the campaign, this is, of course, as you should know, before Columbus discovered America. And more importantly, Columbus discovering America was really the Spanish didn't make that much out of America until they got to Mexico, which is around 1520. Cortez conquered Mexico in 1517, Be'erich, and 1518. And after 1521, 1522, that's when they really started making real money from America. Of course, they made even more money when they conquered the Incas in the 1530s. But so Spain was financially strapped, and the way they were able to conquer, the way they were able to conquer Granada, the last Muslim kingdom, was with the financial assistance of the Abarbanel. Now, when after they conquered Granada, it didn't take long. They decided they should expel the Jews. Very kindly, returning a nice favor. The Abarbanel attempted to bribe them. I believe the number given was 100,000 ducats. I'm not sure exactly how much that is in modern money, but
a lot.
But yeah, it was a big bribe, and they refused. They did actually offer the Abarbanel personally to stay in Spain. They did personally offer the Abarbanel the rights to stay in Spain, and the Abarbanel said, no, thank you. I will go into exile with my people. And that is what happened. He moved on to Italy, possibly Naples. Naples was written down, I believe, over here in the early Achronim. I have a personal problem with Naples. I didn't have time to double-check it. My personal problem is Ferdinand. I'm pretty sure, like 95% sure, that Ferdinand, King of Aragon, ruled Naples at the time. And I'm also equally sure that he applied the expulsion to all of his possessions. So I would find it difficult to say that he went from one Aragon, from one Castilian / Spanish possession to another one. I find that difficult to believe, personally.
Unless he was taking, use of the permission to stay.
No. I don't think that's. I would have to. I didn't have time to. But then he moved on to Venice. Unclear if what he was doing to make a living at the time. He lived another, 16 years or so, 15, 16 years. But we do know what he did do was he wrote on the rest of the Nevi'im. Nevi'im, Nevi'im Achronim. He worked over his parish of Chumash. Part of it he had written earlier, and he found it. He'd gotten lost, and he found it. He also wrote a parish on Bar Nevuchim. He also wrote a parish on Mornevuchim, explanation of Mornevuchim. He wrote extensive chiburim on Mashiach, on times of Mashiach.
We have all of this?
Yes, we absolutely do. Ma'ane HaYeshua. He wrote on Ikrim. And he also wrote on Avos. Now, I think it's pretty obvious, and it doesn't take that much to figure out, that the reason why he wrote on Mashiach and Ikrim was because that was the hot topic at the time. And who did I tell this to just last night? Maybe I can't remember who she was in with about this last night. Anyway, I was talking to someone last night, and I commented that, today, the Christians really don't believe in their own stuff. And I'm not sure. I mean, there's a minority of them who do. But when you ask them any significant question, they say, I don't know. They're either, you guys ever had permission to receive? Permission to receive?
Yeah.
Lawrence Kalman? Lawrence Kalman? Yeah, you've seen it? Okay. So his, he didn't even write all the questions there are on the False Testament. He just wrote some of the basic ones. Okay? There's basic question. Yashka's Yichus, Yashka's lineage is
from
given
David,
from David. His two totally different lists. He asked him two questions. There's two totally different lists.
Wait.
He got to that. There's two totally different lists. That even the one before Joseph, you know, Mary's supposed husband, was a different person. You know, different, everything different. And then, of course, as Menachem said, and anyway, Joseph wasn't his father, so, like, it's enough Gemina. Who cares? So they more or less said back, you're right, you know, sure. But it was written for historiocracy reasons.
I heard that they assumed that the whole thing was made up, and that that was his father.
No, it's explicit in Shas that his father's name was Pandri. You heard a Rebbe called Yashka Pandrus. That's why he's called. That's what the traditional Jewish name for him is Yashka Pandrus.
Is he called that?
Where is he called that?
Because the Gemara says his father's name is Pandri.
No, where is he called that?
His name in Shas is given as Yeshiv. And Yashka is like a diminutive of Yeshiv.
Oh, he's never called that in Shas.
He's called that traditionally by Jews of Eastern European extraction. Your grandmother still alive? No. You knew your grandmother well? No? Grandfather? Did you ever heard him? They never called him Yashka Pandus?
No, I never heard.
Yeah, my grandmother called him Yashka Pandus. Okay, so anyway, that's a well known, it's before Shikamara and Sanhedrin, Samach Beis, and the unedited editions. I'm pretty sure it's Samach Beis. It's hard to find, unfortunately, in the Ozva Hadra, because they put it under the Gilead, they put it under the side of the Gemara. If you look in the Wagshal Gemaras, in the Wagshal Gemaras, they're printed in a slightly different type font, which makes it very easy to find. Yeah, anyway. The point is, it seems to us, or it seems at least to me, they don't really believe that much in it, and there's a lot of very basic questions which they don't bother answering, etc., etc., etc. But you have to understand, between, let's say, 1400 and 1600, it was a big, hot topic. It was a very hot topic. And around, we're going to see, I don't think we'll quite get to it this year, but somewhere approximately around between 1600 and 1650 is when more or less the debate is like totally over. So, but it was a big debate, so the Barbanel has a lot to say about it. Okay, let's go on to the Mizrahi. No, the Bartanura, sorry. I forgot, the Bartanura, I'm going now in order. The Bartanura, Rubavadi Bartanura. Bartanura is a city in northern Italy. And Bartanura lived from 1440 to 1516.
What?
1440 to 1560.
It's a very long time.
1440 to 1516 to 76 years.
Oh, so 1516.
1516.
No,
not 120. No, that's 76 years. Okay. He decided to move to Eretz Yisrael in 1486. Took him 2 years. When we talk about modern history of Jewish settlement in Jerusalem, the Bartanura is considered like the modern. Now, we don't know much of what was going on between the Ramban in about 1270 and the Bartanura in the late 1400s. I would say we know nothing. We don't know that much. From the Bartanura on, we know what I call a relatively solid amount.
But there were always Jews there.
There were always, as far as we know, Jews. There was a short period of time in the first group. There were two periods of time Jews didn't live in Jerusalem. Okay? Two periods of time. One period of time was the first, let's say, 50, 80 years from the original Christian conquest of Jerusalem in 1101 until the Muslim reconquest. And it could be already by the end of that period they did re-allow Jews in Jerusalem. And the other period, much more significant, is the period that Jerusalem was called Aeola Capitolina, after Bar Kokhba's rebellion in 135, until, let's say, solidly for 200 years, Jews were not allowed to live in Jerusalem.
But
So in Eretz Yisrael they still were?
Yeah, in Eretz Yisrael they were, but in Jerusalem not. One would probably assume even a little earlier, the Roman Empire from let's say 280 was under severe decay. So it could be there were a small Jewish community. It's very, very difficult to know. Very difficult to know. Anyway. Fine. He comes to Yerushalayim. He starts, is the most, greatest rabbi by far, head of the community, starts a yeshiva. One assumes, even though we can't prove it, in other words, at later dates, in the classic era of the Achronim, the Jewish community in Yerushalayim, the three holy cities, which are?
Four.
Let's see. Yerushalayim, Tzfat, Hebron, and Tveria. Were supported, where the Jews usually were not able to make enough money to live on, and were supported by shluchim going around collecting. So we don't know if that already existed in the Bartanura's time, but it's definitely possible. After Gerush Sfard in 1492, there was a significant growth of the community because there were some Mugurashe Sfard who came to live here in Yerushalayim. Now, what we know, what's the Bartanura most famous for?
Mishnah.
He's most famous for his parish on a Mishnah.
Is the wine named after him? Or is that like...
Is the wine named after him?
Rashi.
Sort of.
Rashi and Bartanura.
Sort of. It has nothing to do with the price of tea in China. Yeah, okay.
No, it has to do with the Bartanura.
Okay. So now, what's the difference between the Bartanura and the Rambam? No.
Well,
in terms of parish of Mishnah, come on, guys.
Question yourself, keep shot. He's a Rashi and Mishnah is for all intents and purposes.
Okay, so it says that he's sort of like a Rashi and Mishnah in the Rambam. So I would say it in a different way.
The Rambam meant to be a Rashi.
No. The Rambam did not write a Rashi style parish with Dibur Hamasvos. Rather, he writes running commentary on each Mishnah. Each Mishnah, there's a whole Mishnah, there's no Dibur Masvos in the Rambam.
And he doesn't go for the Mishnah, he skips on.
And he's a running commentary, he doesn't have Dibur Masvos. And as it's also pointed out, the Rambam was a very intelligent person, and assumed you had shot basically in a lot of, like, let's say, a certain large amount of the Mishnahs. The Bartanura is a solid 250-300 years later, and he is a lot more helpful. Not only does he break things up more than the Rambam did. In other words, he writes Dibur Hamasal style, like an echo of Rashi.
He realized
not only that, he also is more helpful and doesn't assume as much as the Rambam did that you understand everything. Or not everything. Not everything, but the Rambam understands you are like really functional. The Bartanura is a lot, more amami kilu for the Rambam.
It's amami,
for the masses.
Oh, amen.
It's sort of like the difference between the Bartanura and Kahati. I mean, a Kahati, in my opinion, it is overkill a lot of times because he brings every parish. I mean, what's real overkill is art scrolls. You don't have to have every single parish in the Mishnah possible. And even Kahati, I feel, is a little overkill. But what Kahati is very good for, which the Bartanura won't always do, is he gives very nice hakdamas, prefaces, etc. The Bartanura does. It's, in other words, a similar relationship.
But at the same time, the Rambam wasn't made for...
The Rambam made it for the masses. The proof the Rambam made it for the masses is he wrote it in Arabic.
That's what I'm saying, that he's the information he gave.
The Rambam gives a significant amount less information. And not only that, instead of being like Rashi, that you read the Mishnah and you say, what does this mean? And you look and you find a Dibur Masvel and Rashi helps you. The Bartanura does that. You read the Mishnah, what is this? Bartanura Masvel, I got it. The Rambam doesn't do that. The Rambam Kilo assumes.
How old
is
the Rambam when he wrote Mishnah?
The Rambam wrote Parashat Mishnah approximately from the age of 23 to 30. He wrote Yad, he wrote Mishnah Torah from like 31, 32 to 41, 42. approximately.
Didn't the Rambam write Perusha Mishnah on the run?
He wrote a lot of Perusha Mishnah on the run, yes. His postscript, he has a postscript, I spoke about that. He has a postscript maybe it's a Machshirim. Here's a postscript to Perusha Mishnah in which he says that, and that's considered one of the key pieces of biographical information about the Rambam, where he talks about his adventures in writing Perusha Mishnah. Okay. Okay. Let's see. Now, the other difference between the Batanur and the Rambam is the Rambam. It was very unclear if he was aware of Rashi and Tosfos, and even if he was aware of them, he's Kilo in the same league as them. He doesn't have to shteltsu, as they say in Yeshivish and Yiddish. He doesn't have to.
What does sushtel mean?
It means comparison. But that's not exactly what it means. He doesn't have to bother bringing their opinions because he can hold their opinions wrong. Now, we're a lot after that, and it's not really possible for us. We can't say any Rishon is wrong. I mean, even if a Rishon, if it's a known Rishon, in other words, Rashi, Tosfos, Rambam, etc., it's just one of these, if it's an unknown Rishon, the other Rishon didn't recognize as something, like a lot of these things have been printed in the last 25 years, then, and it's against everything else we see in Rishonim. No, you cannot say it on the Meiri. You cannot say it's true that many people do not believe in using the Meiri like Rabbi Soloveitchik, but no, the Meiri is known. The Shittim Betzis quotes extensively, and the Meiri is definitely a reason. You can't say a Meiri is wrong. I'll give you an example though. There's something called Tosfos Chachmei Anglin. Have you ever seen it?
Yeah, it's quoted.
It's not quoted. It's a sefer printed by Chonu Shalayim between 35 and 45 years ago. And I don't remember which mesecta it's on, but one of the yeshivish mesectas, they showed one of the pieces in the Tosfos Chachmei Anglin to Reb Nachum. And Reb Nachum said, the Englishers never knew how to learn. Okay?
Reb Nachum.
Yeah, okay. So, again, the Bartanura has to take, we'll take Rashi, Tosfos, and the other Rishonim into account, and unlike the Rambam, and as a result, his Perush, unlike the Rambam, who Rambam almost only brings one explanation, which is his, the Bartanura many times brings multiple explanations. And the reason why is very simple, that Bartanura is, he's a responsible person, he's a big gadol in his time, but he's a responsible person. And you can't say that, if there's major machlokas, he has no choice but to bring both of them. Okay, it's not, as you can note, if you learn Mishnayos in the classic format, which means Bartanura, Tosfos, Yontif, there is definitely a makom to add more in, which is why the Tosfos, Yontif came and did it. We'll get to Tosfos Yontif.
What's the actual
idea
to the
Bartanura? A lot. We'll talk about that when we get. I didn't think about it. Look, so the Bartanura, again, his importance is in terms of the Mishnah, and he's a lot more user friendly than the Rambam, as we could say in modern parlance, and to give another pitch for learning Mishnayos. I mean, seriously, as a life observation, there aren't that many people who are real Bekim and Shas. I'm talking about people who are really dedicated. There are some, but they're not that many. And honestly speaking, to learn Shas and know it and remember it in a serious fashion is beyond the scope of most people. That's a fact. I'm telling you the facts based on observation. To know someone who could identify a Gemara within a blot or two on the spot, which is quite good, is a rarity. However, everyone can learn Mishnah. It's not hard to learn Mishnah. It's a lot easier. It's a lot smoother. It's not nearly as complex. You learn Mishnah and you know it well, you'll see the sugyas go about 30 times faster, not 30 times, significantly faster. Because most of Shas, Shas does to Mishnah what Midrash does to Pesukim. Okay? In other words, Midrash takes Pesuk and Pasuk here says, this Pasuk is connected to that Pasuk. Classically, a Pasuk in Chumash it's connected to a pasuk in Tehillim Mishlei Iyov, or sometimes Nevi Machronim. That's classic midrash. Is this and this apply? And that is when Shasta is the same thing Mishnah to Mishnah conceptually, which is we have this Mishnah, what about that Mishnah, how do these two Mishnahs interrelate? So if you are familiar with Shas Mishnahs, and I'm telling you everyone can know Shas Mishnahs as long as you don't use art scrolls. That's if you true. Learn to use art scrolls, you never finish. After you know Shas Mishnahs, it will be no big deal to Chaz or Shas Mishnahs, I would say once every year and a half to two.
Perik
a day. The problem is until you get to Chazar, Mishnah is kilu simple in a certain sense, because it's basic fact. And if you don't Chazar it a number of times, and I mean a number, I mean around 10, and I'm not trying to overwhelm you. I personally Chazar Mishnayas 15 to 20 times before I go on. And then I won't be able to, I can't remember. I mean, you're young, when you're young, you might not have to do it as many times. Once you get older, if you don't do it, if you don't do it 10, 15 times, it's just you can't maintain. I'm not even talking about accurately remembering where something is. I'm talking about being able to find basically something. I mean, there are things in Mishnah is Tarshish Baal Peh, you understand. It's not Tarshish Baal Sa. It's like I was trying to find. There's a Mishnah about Derech, about Tumas Caleb, Derech Aliyah, and Derech Yerida in the Mikvah. You guys know where that one is? I was looking through Caleb back where I took a tour. I took a group of guys last past summer with Rabbi A. Willig to the Ophel Park over there, the Davidson Center. And I couldn't. I looked. I spent hour. I spent at least an hour. Yeah, cheater. I couldn't find it. So now I managed to find it. It's not in Caleb. It's in Shkolim. Mishnah is Torah Shabbat Peh, and the nature of Torah Shabbat Peh is it can be anywhere. In other words, the logical place where it should have been, it wasn't. I thought it'd be in Caleb, I thought maybe it'd be in Mikvos.
That's for sure.
It's a Mishnah in the end of Shkolim. Okay, bye. The Mizrahi, we have to at least do the Mizrahi tonight. The Mizrahi. The Mizrahi's name was Rabbi Elio Mizrahi. I'm not sure, but Spartan had last names. One, I'll give you my educated guess, even though I didn't.
Eastern Europe?
No. He was from Constantinople. Last time I said this year, we talked about the Turks. We talked about the Ottoman Turks conquering Constantinople in 1453.
Eastern Europe?
No, southern.
Constantinople, Istanbul. You don't know where that is?
Turkish.
Yeah, Turkey, the capital of Turkey. It was considered. It was the. Do you know where the Black Sea goes and gets to the Mediterranean?
He doesn't know where the Black Sea is. Hold on, this is the Mediterranean. Right?
It's. Do you know where Europe and Asia hit?
Yeah, by.
So where they touch?
Greece. Greece. You go up Greece, and then there's a little point where they like almost touch, and there's a little strait in between called the Bosphorus. Alexander the Great crossing the Bosphorus. You've never heard of that? Okay, fine. You should. If you can pass the Bechina on Chumash Rashi, I won't get mad at you. Okay, yeah. If not, I'll say, what were you doing in high school?
Am I getting one on Chumash Rashi?
You want one? Okay. Fine, that's what I say. Okay, fine. So, why was he called Mizrahi? I will give you my educated guess. My educated guess is the reason why he's called Mizrahi is to differentiate that he was originally from the east. In other words, his family were not exiles from Spain. They were not exiles from Spain. Rather, they were people who lived in either the Greece, Turkey, Syria area, for a very long time. That's what I would guess. And especially as a fact that he was a Rav, he was in Rabbanus, and Spanish Jews dominate non-Ashkenazi / known by most people as Sephardi Rabbanus, is dominated by Spanish exiles. Dominated. So the fact that he was an Eastern Jew who was in Rabbanus is probably how he got the name Mizrahi, but this is a theory that I practically made up on the spot. Okay. Initially he was a dayan and teacher, but in 1500 he became chief rabbi. As I mentioned 2 weeks ago, last time I spoke about this, As I mentioned 2 weeks ago, last time we spoke about this, the Turks maintained a very philo-Semitic policy, unlike you know, Christian.
They love Jews.
That means they were good to Jews. They didn't care, you know. I'm going to say this statement right now. You're not going to tell me. You're not going to tell me if I said this one in this year. I don't think I did, but maybe I did. Okay. Muslims value political power a lot more than Christians. And when Jews had no political power and were very dependent on Muslim political power, Muslims did not have problems with Jews. I mean, there are exceptions, but the rule is what they value is political power. And they also knew, especially the Turks, were barbarians practically. Turkish language was not a written language until much later. The court language was Farsi.
Yeah,
the court language was Farsi and Greek.
Okay.
Because they conquered the Greeks.
Oh.
They used Jews for trade, more or less. They used Jews for trade, the Greeks for diplomacy. That was classic Turkish policy from approximately 1400 until 1700. Until maybe even 1800. So the Jews were given, the Jewish community in Constantinople was extensive, well-to-do, well enough to do, that even when the Mizrahi was only a dayan, he was able to live off the salary. And when he became chief rabbi was very prestigious, and the Turks fully backed him. And I can't say Vada at his time this is true, but I know later chief rabbis under Turkish rule had Turkish soldiers going around with them enforcing what they said. So one would assume that was true in the earlier times also, even though it's impossible for me to you know, quantify.
Is that indicative of people not listening to them?
No, it's indicative of part of authority means people don't like authority. And ultimately speaking, when social pressure doesn't work, and when two people are fighting about money, social pressure is not going to work. The only way will not work. The only way to enforce it is if you have forces behind you. Okay. What's the Mizrahi Bal best known for? He's best known for his parish on Rashi and Chumash. That's what he's best known for. Now, he's not technically.
Yes, he also is known for the footnotes in Art Scroll.
Ah, thanks, Yitz. He's not technically the first person to write on Rashi and Chumash. But sort of like, I mean, it's not really true. I mean, even illustration, it's not really true. No, he's not. There's a lot of people who wrote on. The Bartanura wrote on Rashi.
Rabban!
No, the Rabban. We'll get there in a moment. There were people who predated him, but in terms of Parshanis and scholarship, the Mizrahi is practically definitive, and everyone who comes after the Mizrahi, to call them heavily influenced by the Mizrahi is an understatement. That's a gross understatement. The Gur Aryeh, the Maharal, if he's not quoting the Mizrahi explicitly, he tacitly, like, sometimes when he argues with him sharply, he won't quote him by name.
Who's the
Sifzei Chachamim? We'll get to the Sifzei Chachamim later. The Sifzei Chachamim is much later, and we'll get. I'm not actually not sure we'll get to him.
It's a hymn, it's not a name.
It's a hymn. Okay, you know what? So we're not going to get there until this year, so I'll explain this. Sifzei Chachamim, I don't even remember what the author's name was. It's really the compiler.
It's Kufa.
I guess, based on who he's bringing from, I would guess around 1700.
Oh, much later.
He even brings the Taz. The Taz died in 1568.
What?
1668. But his parish of Chumash, I'm not sure if it was posthumous or not. It means written after he died, printed after he died. He definitely quotes the Taz, which can't be printed before 1660. So that means at earliest he was in the 1680s. As is well known, he was not a scholar. Or maybe it's not well known. He was not a scholar. The Minig B'nai Yeshivas, which means the custom amongst people from mainline yeshivas is to fight with the Sifzei Chachamim misquotes, and whenever he tries something original, to attempt to absolutely disprove it. How's that? Yeah, there you go. If I don't, you know, someone has to tell you these things, yes. No, when he's quoting, when he's adapting the earlier people, he does a usually acceptable job. But it's a well-known minig b'nei yeshivas, custom b'nei yeshivas. I definitely know that Rav Huttner was a very big proponent of attacking Sifsei Chachamim. I'm not sure to quantify it more than that. I definitely heard it from other sources besides that. It's not like certain things, like there's a certain famous legend about Shabtai Tzvi and the Taz's you know, his grandchildren, which I'm not sure, I hope I'll be able to source, but I'm not sure I'll be able to, that I've heard it from three absolutely different sources. I mean, three people who have mamish, they come from completely different areas, and it's like fascinating. Okay, but over here, I'm not sure. Okay, Vaitan. What does the Mizrahi do in terms of Chumash? So let's just say it out in a clear fashion. Okay, so Yitz says, what about the Ramban? Okay, the Ramban in Chumash, the Ramban in Chumash plays a part similar to Tosus and Shas.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It's
like the quote from Rabbi Chaim. As I told you in the name of Rabbi Chaim Volozhin.
Oh, I heard.
You saw it somewhere else?
Yes, I'm an intro to the Ramban.
But they say, the Hungarians say the same thing in the name of the Pesach Samsov.
Of course they would.
So, not of course they would. You see that it's a readily apparent thing. That just like Tosus completes Rashi and Shas, so too the Ramban completes Rashi and Chumash. Now, it is a fact that the Ramban is more respectful than Tosus. The Ramban is more respectful. He's significantly later. He did not consider himself, as the Ramban says, he doesn't really consider himself an equal. But I didn't have this quote in front of me. You look at the end of the Ramban's poem and at his introduction to his parish on Chumash, unbelievable. The end of it, he says, you know, I really shouldn't be doing this, but what can I do? Nafshi chashka b'tara, and I have no choice but to do it. I have no choice but to get involved.
That's like so, what the Ram said in Ksubas about the riff. Like, I really shouldn't say anything but it's Torah, so I'm going to start.
There you go. So the Ramban is respectful. That didn't stop him from arguing. The Mizrahi is the beginning of classic answering up, working on Rashi. Now, what the Ramban does, what the Mizrahi does, is very basic, intensive sourcing and work on Rashi. In other words, as we know, Rashi did not write in a vacuum. And you know what I mean by that is Rashi had a problem that he knew called Tarkul backwards and forwards.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, it was a big problem he had. And when he opened up a Chumash, he couldn't forget that. So Rashi is coming from Midrashim. He does not always source where he came from. But Rashi, one can find source work, source for at least, in other words, there's the grammatic Rashi's. They also have sources, mainly Rabbeinu Menachem and Rabbeinu Dunash.
Yeah.
Right?
Before you cross.
Right? That's right. They have sources. And the other Rashi's, which the rest of the Rashi, at least 90% of it, if not more, not close to 97% or 98%, Rashi, you know, the Yisod in Rashi, which I believe I said when I talked about Rashi, is Rashi never quotes Yiddish word for word. And that's part of the problem. Oh.
Never?
I wouldn't say never, but I would say, I would put it at least at 80, if not closer to 90, 95% of the time. Rashi, when he's quoting something, has his scalpel out, and he knows exactly, he's changing things, very immense subtleties in the Rashi, the way he does not exactly quote a Gemara, and you must figure, it's not this, the beginning of this work in Rashi, in other words, if there are three opinions or five opinions in the Midrashim, or three opinions in the Sifri, two in the Midrash and one in the Gemara, so what's Rashi doing? The person who starts this is the Mizrahi. Because the Mizrahi is, it's not a populist style sefer, it's like it's heavy. I'm sorry, you know, like Rashi writes with like a delusive clarity, that you could think that, you, that Rashi, I mean, again, he doesn't quote the Midrash most of the time, and it's like, he makes it so smooth, and you're like, it was really simple and really easy. See, I told you guys what the Rav Chaim said about
That's
Rashi.
Like,
I told you what the Rav Chaim said about Rashi. He said,
when
did the Rav Chaim died next year, 36, and around the age of 80. Okay. Maybe even 85. Mm. I think 85 is more like. Okay?
That's kind of.
A little younger, but not that much younger. As the Rav Chaim said about Rashi, Chumash with Rashi, he says, Rashi and Chumash? Azash ve Perish? You're with me? So, to such a difficult commentary? How did they teach it to the children in first grade? Okay, well, the Rav Chaim obviously means that, again, Rashi weaves and waves, weaves and winds his way through the Midrashim and in an unbelievable fashion, and tracking down where Rashi's coming from and what he wants and how to answer, why he picked this and why he didn't say that, the Mizrahi's going to start. So the full-length Mizrahi is not so popular because it is like taking Rashi, making him complicated. He's just not nice. But of course, again, the problem is Rashi really was complicated. It's not the Mizrahi's fault.
Is it fair to say that he's in an analysis of Rashi?
Is what?
He analyzes Rashi.
He does analyze Rashi. Absolutely does. And he's in terms of historical work on Rashi's Perish, the Mizrahi is Rosh Rivisha. The Mizrahi is the first and the one who everyone goes after. Again, the Maral, the Levush, the Maskeldom, all the people coming after the main Meforshei Rashi coming after the Mount Mizrahi are all dealing with the Mizrahi.
I don't actually believe what I'm about to say, but just for the sake of devil's advocate, how do you know Rashi didn't actually just mean Al Peep Shot what he said, and like it really was?
Okay, how do we know? So for that, I'll tell you.
How do we know he didn't just?
Okay. How do we know that? I want you to understand that we're talking about a historical / type issue, which we can't. I mean, I there's no such thing as disproved so far that there's nothing. The devil's advocate, Jewish people who like to argue, can't keep arguing. How do we know it? How do I know that Rashi really meant what he meant? So I'll tell you a story, which I think I said over once or twice, but if not, I'll house it over for you. Tell you how I know it. How do we know? Okay, so I once read a chess article by a Dutch chess master whose name is Hans von Ries. Okay. He's writing an article about history of chess. Chess, as we know it, is not more than 1,300 years old. It was brought to Spain by Persians. And the big question, before 1500, approximately, before 1550, let's say, the queen moved one space in every direction. Modern chess is called Echach Ramadan. That's French, which means chess of the mad queens. The mad queen means you allow the queen to move as many squares in any direction she can. Got it? You have it? That's modern chess. We know that chess before 1550 approximately, queen moved one space in every direction. Question is, how did queen move in original chess, in Persian chess? So most people assume it moved one square in every direction. However, there's a very early chess master who left over the first chess puzzles around the year 800.
She's Persian, she doesn't know.
He's Persian.
The queen.
Wait a second. So, he left over two chess puzzles, which, according to which I don't believe von Ries, duplicated, but they are brilliancies. In other words, a chess puzzle, you say you have a piece here, you set up a board with like five, three or four, or two to four on each side, mate in three moves. Okay? So two of them are like absolute brilliances, and the third one made no sense at all. Made no sense at all. Unless you say that the Persian queen could only move one square diagonally only in any direction.
That would make the most sense.
Then if the Persian queen can move only, and Nathan says, of course, Persians and women, nothing to talk about. If the Persian queen can only move one space in any direction, Then the chess is, then this is another brilliancy, and Van Rees says there's no question at all that in his opinion,
Dekker has to be. I want to be very clear, that was a very hard one today, so it's not like I'm thinking of money. I was tomorrow.
Yeah, okay, tough. Anyway, Bekitzer, the point is when someone has shown accuracy consistently, surgical accuracy consistently, so many places like Rashi has, we go on the assumption that the places where we can't figure it out, it's due to our, you know, inadequacies and you know, lack of intelligence, etc., etc. Rashi's just done too much. He's just done too much to assume that he's not aware of it.
That's why I preface by saying
the Meiri says it. If it's not good enough for you, the Meiri says it explicitly. It's not just my opinion. He doesn't say about Rashi, Chumash on Rashi. He says about Rashi and Chas. But the Meiri says it explicitly about Rashi.
That's why I said I don't actually believe what I was saying.
Yeah, okay, tough. Fine, I'd come.